So hello, welcome. We've got another Ken 7 podcast, and joining me is the the former lead singer of Star Sailor, or well, maybe I should just say, joining me is James Walsh, who was the lead singer of Star Sailor. James, thanks very much for joining me. How are you doing? You all right?
I'm good. Yeah. The band is still a going concern. We're a lot. I can understand why you would think that, because we're a lot quieter than we were in the early days when it was non-stop.
Yeah.
But we have done the odd sort of gig and released stuff every now and again over the last few years. So we're still in touch, and we still get together and do stuff. So
we'll get into that, right? So obviously, primarily we're a Liverpool podcast, although I'm massively into music. So to have you on is brilliant. I get to talk music with someone who's into music, you know. But let's deal with the Liverpool stuff first. So, you know, my first point is, you know, how did you become a Liverpool fan? Where does that come from?
Well, I grew up in Chorley in Lancashire.
Yeah.
And it was pre kind of Blackburn and even sort of Preston to a lesser extent, kind of basically doing a bit better and being the team to support. So everyone in my school pretty much supported either United or Liverpool. And my mates and my older brother all supported Liverpool, or most of them anyway. Liverpool were doing quite well at the time, sort of late 80s, early 90s when I started supporting. I wish it was a more kind of romantic story of like, my dad was a Liverpool fan, his dad was a Liverpool fan, his dad was a Liverpool fan, but there weren't that many choices really. And then it's a weird kind of, I don't know, like a backward sort of glory hunting thing where a lot of the fans who had started supporting Liverpool immediately jumped ship to Blackburn when,
right,
including my brother, when Kenny moved and Jack Walker took over. And I thought, no, despite the fact that we weren't doing particularly well under Graham Souness, I'm going to stick to my guns. I picked Liverpool and that's it. I've got to stand by my choice.
I mean, I don't know whether you said it was a romantic story there. If you say, well, my dad was a fan and my granddad was a fan, but it's not, because that's just bullying. They don't give you a choice in that option. At least you had a choice and chose right. I had no choice at all. And my dad took me to my first game when I was 2.
Right.
and I was asleep the whole game, apparently. He said I woke up when we scored. So, you know, there's nothing romantic about that.
Yeah. My dad, I say that my dad wasn't a fan, my granddad wasn't a fan. My dad does kind of profess to be a Liverpool fan, but it certainly wasn't sort of drummed into us from an early age.
So what are you?
Yes.
What are you like in terms of like being a fan? I mean, how would you describe yourself? I mean, what I was thinking when I was trying to formulate this question was, what are you like on a match day? Because I'm like, the day before, I'm thinking about the game and I'm thinking, oh, I've got a game to watch. You know, even when we're rubbish, I'm looking forward to watching a game. What about you? How does it work for you?
I'm quite an optimistic fan, and no matter how we're performing, I always think maybe this is the game where we turn it around. But yeah, I get excited on a match day, and I do enjoy kind of obviously like following your podcast and the lads on the Anfield Rap. And
yeah,
I think like I was saying earlier, before we kind of started the interview, I feel like the kind of fan podcasts and websites and message boards or Twitter and wherever fans kind of interact It always becomes that bit more animated when things are a bit fraught and things are a bit aren't going so well like they are at the moment, because it's almost like a form of therapy where
Yeah.
everyone's got their kind of theories on what's going wrong and how long term it is. And it's nice to kind of hear from people when you're feeling a bit doom and gloom about it all, hear from people who are like, no, this is a short term
Yeah.
issue, and we're in the right place and we're moving in the right direction, and we've just got to weather this storm. And
Well, I mean, you mentioned them there. I mean, the Anfield Rat Boys, they sort me out when my head's gone. Totally. I wait, their podcasts come out, the post-game podcast, and if something's gone wrong, I can't listen to, if something's gone wrong, I can't listen to the post-game podcast straight away. Give me a couple of days. But then once I do that and then listen to the review, then I start going, ah, okay, well, I can see, yeah. And I mean, are you the same? Does it work like that for you? Yeah.
I think some of the like Neil's post-match reviews are quite funny as well, and quite sort of well written. It's kind of David Peace, reminds me of his sort of writing. So yeah, it's good.
No, he's just very matter of fact, Neil. They're all really good. Like I've had spoke to lucky enough to get Gareth on here and John Gibbons. I've had on a few times, and they're just good lads. You know what I mean? Nothing's too much trouble for them. They've been they're brilliant. And then, like I say, that it's like therapy. They talk you round. But I mean, like you say, Twitter in particular is very toxic, and there's no level ground. It's either awful or we're the best thing in the universe, you know what I mean? And you get all of those opinions, you have to just shrug your shoulders. I mean, what looking at those sort of comments, especially the toxic ones, that does that annoy you? How do you feel about it?
Definitely. I think I find like the not just with football but with everything, it's like the older I get, the more it's in some kind of contradiction. The more sure I am of my opinions and my kind of worldview, but also the more sensitive I am to people who challenge that, or even in a ridiculous way where like you say, it's toxic, it still kind of gets to you a bit, and you think, oh, that's sort of, I don't know that I've got a thick enough skin to just get on there and be like, blah, this is what I think. And
Yeah.
because when people sort of bite back, it's like, oh, that's could do without that or something.
Yeah. I think sometimes I feel very defensive of my club sometimes when people have that opinion, and it's their club as well. But I get very like, no, don't be saying that. You know, these lads are great. You know, they've what they've done for us and all that. It's difficult to level it out in your mind, I think. But just look at the season we've had. I know obviously it's not been what we wanted. How do you assess what's gone on there?
I don't know where do you start?
Where do you start?
Obviously, losing Van Dijk, I think, was a massive blow.
But we
'Cause
coped
he's
without Van Dijk for a while, for a good while. I mean, we were top of the league at Christmas, but it's almost we lost Matip as well at that point. I mean, we coped without Van Dijk and Gomez for quite a while, but then I think almost like mentally when they lost Matip, it was, oh, you know, what are we going to do? What are we
He's
going to do now?
playing so many games without any recognized central defenders. It's like, no, that's yeah. And people talk about, well, City have had to cope without this player or that player. But when they've lost key players in defense in the past, they've fell apart as well. It's like
Last season, they lost Laporte and had to put Fernandinho back there, and it didn't work.
So it's I think it's definitely a big factor, and the pressure of winning it last season, and the fans playing such a massive part in that as well, and them suddenly being gone. Yeah,
no one can tell me that we lose six games at home on the bounce in a full stadium.
No,
it's just not happening.
No,
it's not happening. So the, I mean, it is a factor, and I've had a lot of people say the fans, and I'll always counter it by going, "Well, the fans haven't affected Man City." But when you get freak results like those six, it certainly tells you something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Completely.
And I think the kind of lack of confidence, obviously Salah's still banging them in, but the lack of confidence up front as well. And that's another thing that the fans would have, you look at how Mane struggled recently, the fans would have been right behind him and really G'ing him up and getting him going. And I don't know, I don't want to make assumptions on how he ticks. And Firmino as well is another player who thrives off that reaction. I don't want to make assumptions on what's going on in their heads or what makes them tick, but that could well be a factor.
I mean, you can compare it to your game and how would you feel about playing in the MEN arena with no one in there doing a live stream in the MEN arena on a stage?
Yeah.
It wouldn't feel right. You know, when you go on stage, you get that extra 10%, don't you?
Yeah.
When you hear people singing back and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's exactly the same. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, I think a good example of that is like doing streamed gigs or doing live streams where when you're playing live and something goes wrong, it's obviously nerve wracking, but if you've got a good crowd behind you, they keep encouraging you and they stay with you.
Mm.
Whereas when you're doing a live stream, you might get the odd encouraging comment, like, you know, when like the stream goes a bit wonky or whatever, you get the odd encouraging comment, but otherwise you kind of feel lost and you're like, oh, this whole thing's unraveling. And
I get that.
And maybe there's a bit of that with the players where they make a mistake and you think, fuck, this is, sorry for swearing. They think, oh no, this is all going wrong. And because there isn't the crowd there to kind of keep them, to get them up again, to go, no, we're still behind you, keep fighting, keep at it. The whole thing just kind of, I know they're kind of professional athletes and they should obviously be able to do that on their own without any crowd in the stadium, but it's bound to have an effect, I think.
Mm. Just before we move on to music, I just wanted to get a brief comment off you on what you thought about the European Super League while it was all going on and everything.
I'm glad it's not happening now. I think, like most people, although there must be some people in football and in who are fans of football who would have supported something like that. Otherwise, how do sort of top businessmen who've made millions, if not billions of pounds, decide that that might be a good idea? It's like somebody somewhere wants it and wanted it. But yeah, in terms of Liverpool being a club for the community and also a club that's prided itself on being the best on merit, especially when Shankly took over and took us from a second division team to winning FA Cups and winning leagues left, right and centre, then the Super League kind of, like a lot of the fans have said, goes completely against that.
Mm.
The one thing I will say is that, and this is kind of going off topic slightly and a bit political, but I think it'd be nice if people who held that view about football, of socialism and of a club being part of the community and to be protected at all costs, it'd be nice if people held that view about the health service and about the arts and thought beyond the dog eat dog capitalist culture. Whereas I feel like some people are like, let's protect football at all costs, but let everything else kind of the survival of the fittest kind of thing, where it's like, no, let's look at everything and make everything work for the communities that need it, really.
Well, there was an interesting parallel with the racism campaign.
Yeah, on my soapbox a bit there.
Yeah. But there's an interesting parallel, you know, with the racism campaign, and you know, that's been done, but the reaction wasn't anywhere as fervent as it was for the European Super League, and that must be a frustration for the people who are running those campaigns, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Patrick Bamford said that when he came out after the Leeds game. And that's another thing that's annoyed me as well, is not his comments. They were really good, and like you say, made a lot of sense. But the club's kind of coming out and getting on their high horse about when I think everyone, especially West Ham, if West Ham were invited to that, they'd jump at the chance. Yeah. So.
Well, I think on Monday Night Football, they had the Crystal Palace chairman on, and Jamie Carragher sat there, and he come on being all high and mighty, and Jamie Carragher went, well, let's go back to the fact that when the pandemic hit, you tried to use that as a way of null and void in the league so that you weren't at risk of relegation. And he glossed over it, didn't respond.
Yeah.
He started talking about something else, like what he had for tea or something. You know, it's an interesting point.
I think self-interest.
Yeah,
self-interest through most clubs, really. It's just different kinds of self-interest. Of course. And maybe the Super League was just the other things that we've kind of grown up with and accepted, like the TV influence, the like loads of owners of football clubs that maybe aren't the most moral people. Maybe the Super League was just the tip of the iceberg where people finally woke up and went, now this is too far.
Yeah.
All the other things we've learned to live with and accept. But
I mean, if you think about it, the main problem that people had was the lack of competition. So the no promotion, no relegation for the 12 clubs. If you think about it as a football fan, that I'm sure the owners thought they're going to be made up. There's going to be no risk, going to be in it every year. We don't have that whole stress of trying to qualify, and if you don't, you miss out. Mm. The fans will be delighted, but it doesn't work like that, because, you know, as much as we hate the lows, we love the highs, and you don't get one without the other. So, you know, we played Newcastle the other day, and like you said, full of hope. We'll do this, and we'll go 2 points ahead of the, you know, Chelsea and West Ham, and then we don't do it, and you feel like utter shit. But you know, that's football. That's why we love it so much, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this season, especially the last few games, is kind of as our long-term, or not long-term, medium-term goals of like winning the Champions League or even qualifying for the Champions League, if they've started to ebb away, it reminds me of supporting Liverpool in the kind of mid-90s or early 90s, when we would regularly finish 7th and 8th, and you took each game by game, you think, oh, we've won today, that's great. You're not even looking at what it means to the bigger picture, because there isn't a bigger
picture. By this stage of the season, you're really hopeful, but by this stage of the season, it's just an acceptance that nothing's going to happen. Yeah, I get that. You've just brought it up. We said before we started, didn't we? The game on Saturday reminded me of the time when we were close. We were under Roy Evans and David Roy James Evans. Clapping at crosses every week, you know, and we were the Coventry game where we lost two goals in the last 5 minutes. Just reminded, that's how I felt then. And I was a young man then. I'm an old man now, and I still felt the same way. If you're enjoying this video so far, please show your support for the Ken 7 channel by subscribing, clicking the like button, and also clicking the notifications button as well to get future broadcasts. If you could also share the video on your Twitter and Facebook account, that will show YouTube's algorithm that you like our content. Have you heard about Ken 7 merchandise? The link is in the description of this video. We have premium fanware for fans covering Liverpool, Celtic and Scotland. And it's fanware for young and old. So we have t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, caps, mugs, you name it, we've got it. Just something else to remember, every purchase that is made on our website, we donate to the Marina Dalgliesh Appeal. So you're helping a great cause as well. Let's have a chat about music, because you've just released a single, but it's off the back of an album, isn't it, called Small Illusions, which you released in February. It's a solo album. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what is that what you've been doing with your time during lockdown, a lot of writing and using it productively?
Yeah, I've been writing most days, really. I think, like I say, you kind of wake up every day and feel a bit lost because there isn't... there aren't gigs happening and the music industry and world has kind of slowed down a little bit. So you can't, I feel like more my own boss in a way, where I'm writing and recording in my own time and hopefully these kind of songs will do something, but the main thing is that they've kept me occupied and given me something to do. This year is 20 years since the Star Sailor album Love Is Here.
Mm-hmm. I've so made that was... note as well, by the way. I've actually got that note.
So the original plan was that it was going to be quite busy with activity kind of surrounding that, which is still happening later in the year. But I think as that's been pushed back and back, I've had that, used that as an opportunity to do more solo stuff. And just.
I had a quick look through your YouTube channel, and obviously, I mean, you looks like you've been really busy in lockdown. There's loads of videos of you that on there. Obviously, I'm guessing you did some streams earlier on when the pandemic hit, and then you've done some really cool covers. Two of them that I really liked was Love Will Never Tear Us Apart.
Yeah.
I love that song anyway. And also The Book of Love by, is it Peter Gabriel?
Originally by Magnetic Fields, but Peter Gabriel did an amazing
version. It's the Peter Gabriel version that I know, because I've sang that at a gig. Someone requested it and I found it, it was... quite a steep learning curve, but what an amazing song. So, I mean, have you enjoyed that part of it?
I think it's always a double-edged sword with covers when you're a songwriter and kind of made my name with the band or whatever. Mm-hmm. Some people really like it and enjoy hearing my interpretations of the songs, and some people like, now get back to doing your own stuff and writing your own stuff. I think it's just, it kind of, it's good for sort of catching people's ear who might not be a fan of the band, who randomly come across a cover, and that's their introduction to the rest of the stuff I do. It's hard to kind of, describe it in any more artistic or grandiose terms when it's just, like I say, you kind of get up every day and think, well, there's nothing pressing in the diary, so what am I going to do? I'll just learn another song and post it online and see what happens.
I get that. I totally get that.
It's nice. Yeah, it's nice to get the feedback as well. You kind of, without the ability to go out and play gigs and be reminded of that people like you and people like your music, then online is the other way of getting that. Because I think artists are this contradiction of massive insecurity and massive ego, where it only takes one video that doesn't get very many comments or likes or one gig that's not very well attended, and you think, well, that's it, no one likes me, that's the it's the end of the world.
No,
And
I
then
get it.
next week you play a packed out gig, and it could only be like a 30 capacity venue, and you're like, yes, back
They're the
in.
best ones. The
Yeah,
small ones where it's a little
yeah,
tight room are all where
yeah,
everyone's on top of you. I think they're the
yeah,
best. Do you know what I mean?
yeah, yeah.
You feel like you're one unit, everyone together, all enjoying the same experience. So I totally get that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's the same for most people, though. If you run a cafe and you have a day where you're rushed off your feet, and then a day where no one comes in, you probably think, oh, I'm useless at this. I'm not. No one likes our coffee, and the pastries are all stale, and I might as well give up. So.
Something I was going to ask you, obviously, seen in your career in the music industry, you've seen a lot of changes. So what I'm talking about there, the obvious one is the advent of streaming and the accessibility of music digitally. But the other one, which sort of goes hand in hand with that, is that back in the day when you were releasing Love Is Here, you would have written songs, probably done some demos, and then you'd have gone to a studio to record it expensively. Now, I'm sure that version of the process is still valid, but with the advent of people having studios in the home where you've just got literally a computer and some maybe a little dummy keyboard like that one behind me, and you can do all sorts of stuff on that. Has that changed the industry for the better? Because a lot more people, and then also you don't need a record company to get your music out. There's all sorts of platforms. You can do it yourself. TuneCore, pay 49 quid, bang. There's you're on iTunes, Spotify. Has that helped or has that hindered the industry? Have you even thought about it, James?
I think probably a bit of both, really, just to kind of sit on the fence there.
I think
I
that's the
think
right answer.
it's great that, like you're saying, it's definitely benefited me that, because that's literally what I've done, is like recorded these songs on my own at home, gone on CD Baby and set up a release, and I love that freedom, and I love that that kind of simple process, really. Whereas, like you say, in the old days, you'd record songs and wait nervously to see if a label would pick them up, or even with our own label, there's always a chance that a band will believe in a set of songs that they've written, and then the label goes, "No, we that's not. There's no singles there." Or so, in that respect, I think it's good that. And it makes the audience, the A&Rs, then they're the people who go yay or nay. But I think the downside to that is the sheer volume of content, of songs coming out and albums coming out. There's no gatekeepers anymore. There's no labels or platforms to go, this is what you should be listening to. There's no NME either. There's no, well, they're online, and they kind of,
But
but
you
they're
think
not as powerful, or.
that was a good thing to have? I mean, there's many, many incredible songs in history where a record company has said, and the first one that springs to mind is Bohemian Rhapsody, where the record company went, oh no, it's too long, it's weird, what are you doing? And Queen have stuck to the guns. And basically, obviously, at that point, had a bit of power so that they could do it. But, do you think that because the companies don't have the power anymore and people can release the music, I would say that's a good thing, that it's your choice as a listener to. I mean, I think the only problem is the volume of stuff. I very rarely listen to an album back to back now. Because you just don't, it doesn't work like that. Whereas back in the day, you did. You'd have a CD and you'd put it in, and Christ, I sound so old. But I mean, I get what you're saying about the filter. What would you say to that?
I don't know. I think it's just a shame that shows like Top of the Pops aren't around anymore. And
yeah, totally.
later with Jules Holland is, I think it's still going, but it's
it
not
is,
got
yeah.
the, it's not got the influence that it had. It's not the kind of appointment viewing that it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Obviously, like places like the NME and Q and labels, particularly cooler kind of indie labels, had a massive influence on what became popular. And sometimes that was good. Sometimes they championed a band and kept banging the drum of a band who maybe aren't necessarily immediately accessible, but because particularly young people are more impressionable and want to get something that everyone's saying this is great, and so they persevere with it, and then eventually they get it, and they're like, yeah, Joy Division were worth persevering with, the Stone Roses even.
Yeah.
Whereas now it feels like without those kind of guides, it's the most accessible music that's rising to the top, rather than maybe the stuff with the most artistic merit.
Okay.
But that makes me sound a bit snobbish. But
no, I
want
totally
to
get where you're coming from now. I get where you're completely.
We want to kind of live in a world where there's a place for all that stuff. It's like, all that, like the sea shanty craze. It's like there's nothing wrong with that in of its own kind of thing, and people enjoy it and it's great, but it shouldn't overshadow or dictate kind of music and what labels are signing and where it's going. It's gone a bit too far in that direction where people are, it used to be that the labels led. In fact, I'm gonna try and make some sense of the thoughts in my head. It used to be that labels led trends and led where music was going to an extent, and they obviously made mistakes and messed things up. And now it's the public who are doing that, who are saying, like, they're watching someone doing a sea shanty 5 million times, so labels going, we've got to sign that. That's where music's going.
Yeah.
And I think there are, I'm back on the fence now. It's like there are upside downsides to, there are idiots at record labels and there are idiots in the general public.
I love it. Yes. No, completely agree with that. What I wanted to ask you was, when you and the boys got together in the band.
Yeah.
You obviously, usually bands have similar influences and you like the same music and you become a band and then you write that music, that stuff that pleases you. What were your influences generally in the band?
Jeff Buckley. I grew up with Britpop, so Oasis, Blur, Pulp.
Mm-hmm.
All those bands were a massive influence. Watching The Verve at Hay Hall, that was a big moment for me.
Mm.
Probably the moment where I thought, yeah, I want to take this seriously and kind of form a band and do it for a living. It's weird to look back on those years where was so sure that it's what I wanted to do and it felt so normal and legitimate to me, and now I'm a bit older. I think my mum and dad must have thought I was mad.
Yeah, no, I understand that completely. That
at
naivety.
The time I was, yeah, at the time I'm like 17, 18 and going, well, I'm going to be in a big band and that's my kind of destiny or whatever cheesy words I was using. And I was annoyed that they weren't like, well, of course you are, yeah, we'll Well, to be fair, they were very encouraging, but they were like, "Make sure don't get your hopes up." And I was like, "I am going to get my."
That's such a British opinion. Like, if that was an American family, they'd be go, follow your dream, go for it. You know, you can achieve anything. And Brits are like, yeah, it's probably not going to happen, but give it a good go. You'll be all right. Yeah.
Yeah, they've always, like I say, they've been very encouraging, but they were maybe like, don't put all your eggs into one
Yeah.
basket. That's another one.
Yeah.
And now I'm a bit older, and I think, yeah, that probably was a crazy thing to kind of
Completely.
stamp my foot over.
Yeah.
And it's mad. It's just madness that it actually worked out. And
Yeah.
I feel incredibly lucky that
Yeah.
I'm one of the 1% who said I'm going to be in a big band and make it in
Achieve it.
music, and it actually happened.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, listen, it's been lovely to talk to you, James. Thanks very
Cheers,
much. I
you too.
appreciate it. And where can people go and buy the album?
It's on all the usual streaming platforms. There's some CDs and T-shirts and stuff at the T-shirtsshop.com. And I've got a new song coming out called "Bird in the Garden," which you can pre-save on Spotify now.
Brilliant.
Everything's on my Instagram and
Yeah.
Twitter pages anyway.
Lovely. Oh, well, listen, thanks very much, mate. Appreciate talking
Cheers.
to you. If you watch this on YouTube, just click the subscribe button and give the video a like. And we'll see you again soon. We'll have some more content the rest of the week. Thanks very much for watching. Cheers.